Hi, I'm Pamela Bruner from MakeYourSuccessEasy.com, and this is the Million Dollar Audio. This is a recording of a class I did with Jack Canfield, creator of Chicken Soup for the Soul, who talks about how he overcame his limiting beliefs about money to become a multimillionaire. And you'll hear us do a very special tapping routine where I lead Jack through a process that enabled him to create an additional $1 million income stream for his business. Enjoy the audio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special bonus call for Tapping into Six Figures. I'm your host, Pamela Bruner of MakeYourSuccessEasy.com, and I am so excited today to have as our special guest speaker, Jack Canfield. Now, one of the reasons I'm so excited is I'm sure you've heard of Jack. He's built a publishing phenomenon with the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, and he's also the author of The Success Principles, which is one of my absolute favorite books on success ever. But the reason I'm so excited about having him on the call today is that he's going to share with us some of his story about how he started from really a very poor background and then grew not only his business and his life, but he had to grow his mindset first to achieve a multi-million dollar business and life. So I'm so glad that he's going to share that with us today. Welcome, Jack.
Hey, my pleasure to be with you, Pamela.
So I know that people on this call are familiar with your work because I've told them a lot about you, and, of course, they already know about you. Mm-hmm. So why don't we dive into your early story? Because I love your story about deciding in your 20s that you were going to be a millionaire. Can you tell us about that and the path that you had to take?
Well, we can even go back a little further than that. I grew up in a very poor family in West Virginia. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't live in a shack in the, you know, back in the valley somewhere, but, you know, small suburban frame house. And, you know, my dad made $8,000 a year. That's eight with three zeros after it. A family that was, you know, looked at rich people with suspicion. They must have screwed somebody over to get there. Didn't trust them. You know, my dad he wasn't a union member, but it was that mentality of, you know, working class brain set. And you grew up and you worked for someone else, and if you were lucky, you got a job with a big company like the phone company or the gas company or IBM, and you'd have a job for life and be blessed if you did. You know, and people had gone off to war and survived, both my father and my stepfather, one in the Air Force, one in the Navy, from World War II. So there was a sense of just, you know, complacency and resentment, I think, would be two main features of growing up, and just, you know, you're born into a place, you should stay in your place and, you know, do things right and don't make the authorities mad at you, and hopefully things will work out. So there was a sense of not the kind of background you'd think someone comes from and becomes a millionaire. Unlike my cousin, my mother's sister married into a very wealthy family. And as a result of that, you know, she had a mansion on the hill, and he ran the insurance companies in town and had four cars and, you know, a six-car garage, one, I think it was a tractor in one and a boat in the other. And so just a very different reality. And it was when I was in my 20s, I went off to school. I was 18. I got a scholarship to go to Harvard. And, you know, I was smart, but I wasn't as smart as most people think Harvard. I was from West Virginia. They took two kids from West Virginia every year. They called it geographic distribution. If I'd been from California, I don't think I'd have ever gotten in because there were just too many people applying from there. And all of a sudden met people with names like Larry Rockefeller, Max Factor III, John Hopkins IV, and DuPonts and things like that. So it was like I became aware of a very wealthy group of people, and I saw how they lived, and I saw the travel they had, the health care they had, the clothes they had. I mean, I was wearing clothes from a secondhand store in college, and I remember buying two best purchases of my life was a tweed jacket for $10. It was a sport coat that probably some kid just sold for some gambling money or buy some beer with. And the other was a navy jacket that was lined with actual fleece from a sheep, and it was the kind you wore on an ice cutter up in Alaska. And I bought that for $8, and I worked for 4 years all through the cold Cambridge winters. But the reality was I just got exposed to all of these kids with their wealth, and I thought, I want that. I want to have the ability to travel, to get educated, to do the things I want to do in my life. And so I made that decision, and it wasn't until, you know, I was out of college and into graduate school, that I met a man named W. Clement Stone, who was a self-made multimillionaire worth $600 million. And I ended up taking a workshop at his foundation on, it's called Achievement Motivation. I was a teacher, a high school teacher at the time. And how do you motivate kids to want to achieve more? And all of these inner city kids didn't have that. And so as I began to work with him, he began to teach me all this information about prosperity consciousness and, you know, abundance consciousness, law of attraction. And that's when I really set the goal to, in 1 year, make $100,000, when up until then my highest income had ever been for 1 year was $8,000. And just like my dad, so there I was, you know, hitting that ceiling again. And so because of what I learned from Stone, I tell the story in the movie The Secret, I was able to achieve that. And we can talk about some of the principles I applied, but it was literally a decision I made that I wanted to grow up and I wanted to be wealthy like my uncle and the kids at Harvard. And at the time, I didn't realize all that that meant, but it was clear that that was a better way to live than the way I grew up.
I so appreciate you sharing that, because I know that you've just dispelled a lot of beliefs for people who are listening to this call that in order to be wealthy, you need to come from wealth. And I just love your story about choosing a life of wealth.
I just had this funny thought in my head that, you know, you talk about people being born with a silver spoon in their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I was born with a plastic spoon in my mouth.
Yes, but it worked well for you.
No, it did. Who knows why we make these decisions? I think at some mm-hmm. point, whether it's past life karma or present life awareness or a gift from reading a book or seeing a movie, or just that aha moment when you begin to go, wait a second, I have a choice here. This is not fate. I was watching this new Piers Morgan interview. He's replaced Larry King on CNN last night. He was interviewing the guy, the black kid that was in the movie The Blind Side. In other words, mm-hmm. the story, the real kid who the movie was written about and made about. There's I think he's an offensive or defensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens. Professional football team now, and he was talking about he just made a decision. He was getting out of the ghetto, and once he made that decision, if you believe in the law of attraction, which I do, he attracted that woman that was played by Sandra Bullock, the mother, to take him into the family. I mean, there were thousands of kids in Memphis who were playing football, who were black, who could have used a hand up, but he said, I made that decision, and that's what happened. And so I think I made a decision, and then I began to attract the people into my life and also then take actions, obviously, as well.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because I can see that there are a lot of other choices you could have made. Like, you mm-hmm. could have made the choice to be sort of a poor snob, like, you know, I'm poor, but I'm better than you because I'm poor. And I've seen mm-hmm. that with a lot of spiritual people.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you know, making the decision that you want to go for that rather than sort of doing the sour grapes thing. That's great.
Mm-hmm. I had a little of that going in there. I mean, I that was one of the negative beliefs I had to overcome as I got older. Even though I made a decision to be successful and to be wealthy, one of the things that underlay the mental mindset that I grew up with was that spirituality and being wealthy didn't necessarily go together. I mean, I went to a Presbyterian church that was the church in town of the wealthy. And believe it or not, this is kind of sick, but it was true at the time. I was in the youth fellowship, and there was a weekend where we were asked to do the ecumenical thing where you go to a different church. And mm-hmm. so my pastor said to me, Jack, because I was a leader in the youth fellowship, he said, what church are you choosing to go to? And I said, I'm going to go to the Catholic church, because my mother had been Catholic and got excommunicated when she got divorced, and I was curious about Catholicism. And he actually took me into his office and said, I wouldn't advise that. And I said, why is that? And he pulled down a map of the world, and it had all the countries that were Protestant and all the countries that were Catholic and all of their gross national products. And, you know, he said, now, if you go to Lutheran or you go to the Baptist church or you go to this church, whatever, Methodist and so forth, he said, look at these countries that are primarily Protestant. Their gross national product is higher, let's say, than Italy or us, that are more Catholic. And he was absolutely adamant about the fact that, you know, this was the church to belong to if you wanted to be successful. And I thought, oh my God, it was the beginning of my distrusting a lot about what I was being taught. It just seemed so weird to me. But that was part of the belief that, you know, certain kinds of spirituality, especially like Hinduism and Buddhism, look how poor they all are. You just didn't go there. And as I got into Eastern religions, not so much for the religious value, but for the meditation techniques I was learning, that idea of if you're spiritual, if you're wealthy, you'll be corrupted. You know, money corrupts and absolute money corrupts absolutely kind of thing. So I was that was an issue for me. It was one I had to overcome.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you did. You don't feel conflict now between being spiritual and making money.
No, I actually have a little mantra that goes, the more I serve, the more faster money flows to me. The more I love and act spiritually, the greater God bestows his wealth upon me. So I used to, you know, one of the beliefs was money is the root of all evil. And, you know, I say now money is the root of all philanthropy. And so I wanted to be a philanthropist, and you can't do that. You know, I think Bob Proctor once, he's one of the guys in The Secret, said, you know, if you're not wealthy, the amount of good you can do is generally limited to the physical environment that you find yourself in, because that's what you can do. He said, if you're wealthy, you can make a difference all around the world with your money. And, you know, I've written checks for $100,000 to foundations and to nonprofits. And that $100,000 check made a huge amount, whether it was in Ecuador in the rainforest or whether it was in, you know, India doing cataract operations for people in third world countries that would allow them to become self-sufficient and work again and take care of their families and so forth. So I've definitely overcome that. I think that, you know, you look at the Catholic Church, the wealthiest organization in the world, other than perhaps the U.S. government, if you don't deal with its debt load. But the fact is that, you know, they've got a lot of money and you know, that's certainly a spiritual organization. So, you know, I've overcome that, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other limiting beliefs that you had to overcome to get from where you started to where you are now. Mm-hmm. I think you said something about making money in education was one.
Well, you know, for me, I was an educator. I started out as a high school teacher. I just got hooked by the civil rights movement, and I saw the best way to support the empowerment of African Americans and other minority groups in America was through education. And so I ended up teaching in an all-black school in Chicago. I was going to Jesse Jackson Church. I was very involved in all that work. And so, you know, I didn't make a lot of money as a teacher. And then I became a teacher trainer, and then I started to have this, I confronted this belief that you can't charge a lot of money in education because, number one, it's a service organization. Teachers are doing it out of their passion to make a difference. Nobody gets rich in teaching. You know, principals, even superintendents don't make a lot of money. And so I felt guilty if I was charging, you know, a lot of money for teaching and training teachers and writing books for teachers and so on and so forth. And what happened for me, interestingly enough, when it really came around and confronted me was I was hiring myself out at $300 a day for a workshop. And even that felt like a lot of money. And I ran into one of my graduate student friends one day. His name was Hanuch McCarty. And he was a professor at Cleveland State University at that point and also a consultant. And I said, what do you get when you do a day of consulting for education? He said, $800, I think it was. Yeah, $800. And I thought, wow, how do you get $800 from a school system? And he simply said, I ask for it. And I thought, whoa. And I thought, I'm as good as he is because I was seeing him present and I saw myself present. So I remember thinking to myself, I have to overcome this belief that I'm not worth that. So I started looking in the mirror every morning and pretending someone was asking me to consult, and they would say, what's your fee? And I'd say, $800. What's your fee? $800. What's your fee? $800. And I would practice that. And then I got a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to come out and do a weekend workshop, and they said, what's your fee? And I went, $600. I just couldn't bring myself to say it. And the guy on the other line of the phone, he said, no sweat. And I said, okay. I said, I'll do it for $600. What would have been sweat? He said, well, we had $1,200 in the day in the budget. And I went, really? And so I'd left $600 on the table. Mm-hmm. So the next guy that called me, He said, what's your fee? I said, $1,200. He went, well, we only have, I think it was nine or something like that. And I said, done, we'll do it. So literally I had quadrupled my fee. But when I say that, I took a minute to say, it took me a month to do that. And I was literally shaking and I was sweating when I asked for that amount of money. It was kind of like asking, you know, Nicole Kidman out for a date or something. It just was so scary. And fear of rejection, fear of being seen as, I didn't want to be seen as someone who didn't care about kids. I had this big mm-hmm. self-image that I had to look like I was, you know, totally into this for the service of it. And it wasn't okay to be self-serving, to want to make money. And it had to do with, you know, my own sense of my own worth and the worth of what I was teaching. And I was projecting it out into the rest of the world and not seeing how valuable I was. So that was a huge, huge issue for me. And I believe you can make money in education. I mean, I eventually wrote a book called 100 Ways to Enhance Self-Concept in the Classroom. And we sold 400,000 copies of that book, and I made about 25 cents a copy. So I made $100,000 in a couple of years just in royalties off that book. And later I went on to do keynotes and things for education conferences where I would charge as much as $25,000 for an hour of talking. And I have many, many friends who've done that and developed curriculum guides and so forth and done very well. But that took a while for me to overcome that. I mean, back then we didn't have EFT and tapping and so on. So, you know, those resources weren't available. It was more of sheer willpower and the use of affirmations and visualization and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you were probably glad you were on the phone rather than in person with that interview.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, I'd actually like to explore that just for a
sure.
minute or two, because it seems to me that when you have that kind of limiting belief, or what I would say is that fear of rejection, if I ask too much, if I'm seen as greedy or that I don't care about the kids, you know, as you said that, what occurred to me is it feels like your fear or your image or needing to look good is actually getting in the way of your mission.
Absolutely. It was getting in the way of my mission in two ways. Number one, it didn't allow me to have the resources that if I'd had them, I could have reached out and done even more, hired staff, hired PR people for my books to get my book into more hands of people that would make a difference in the classroom, as well as to provide myself with a better life. So absolutely, it was in the way of my mission and in the way of my purpose. And in the way of my own soul's fulfillment. So, I mean, on all those levels, it was a block. I mean, I think fear anytime is a block. And, you know, I've said this before and you've heard me say it, that I think there are only two major emotions, love and fear. And we're either coming from love and wanting to serve and share and give. And often we need to serve and love ourselves as well, so there's balance. But also then there's fear, which just gets in the way of clear thinking, in the way of taking the actions we need to take and to not worry about rejection. It's just a numbers game, all of those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Great. Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, I've got some more questions to ask you, but it feels like mm-hmm. since we're on the topic of fear that this might be a good time to do some tapping. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned to me that you actually had something that you wanted to tap on around me.
Yeah, I think because it's still an issue. Someone once said to me that there are certain core issues in life that you rarely ever fully transcend them. They just come around later at a higher level in the spiral. We're spiraling up toward God consciousness. So there was an issue for me of like asking for $800 a day. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was working with a man named John DeVore, who you know, who does some work that helps release blocks and so forth. And I was just invited to go see him by a friend who said, you ought to see this guy. He's cool. And I went in there and he said, what do you want to work on? I said, well, I really don't have anything to work on. I just came because a friend told me I should. But if there was anything, I just would like to make $8 million in 1 year, and I haven't done that. And I've gotten up to six, and I feel like it's my staff that's holding me back, and I just can't get them to wrap their head around that kind of money and hold that vision for, you know, our little small company to do that level of gross revenues that would produce $8 million for me. And he said, well, let's muscle test you. And so I put my arm out, and he said, I feel comfortable making $1 million a year. My arm was strong. And we went up, and as soon as I hit $8 million, my arm went weak. And he said, no, it's not them, it's you. So we worked on that, and I got comfortable making more money. But what I realized this year is that we started to do some, well, I don't know what we want to call them, but more like exotic retreat trainings as opposed to just trainings. Like we sponsored something in Hawaii where we had 20 people. And we were going to take 20 people in this 10,500-square-foot home on the ocean, had 7 master bedroom suites. Some people had to stay off property. And we would do this workshop for 4 days in Maui, and we would charge $20,000 a person. And I just thought, that's crazy. Who would pay that? And I don't even want to be seen as asking for that. Again, it put me back in that I'm just in it for the money kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the weird part is Patty Aubrey, my president of my company who runs the thing for me, said, we're going to do it, and if I can fill it, will you show up? I went, okay, you put the copy together and fill it. Well, anyway, she filled it with a waiting list. We had 20 people with 6 people on a waiting list, and that was after interviewing 30 people on a group of 60 people who sent in applications. We didn't even interview 24 of them, so there might have been more. And that kind of made me realize, wow, it is me again, you know, perhaps holding things down here. So I thought, yeah, that would be a good thing to tap on, and everyone else can tap along with us. And while I'm going to a, what is it, a seven-figure, tapping into a seven-figure income,
right.
they can tap along into their six-figure income.
Absolutely. I actually want to narrow this down because it's a great example. And one of the things I love about you is your vulnerability and transparency, that you're, you know, always willing to share what you're working on, because it's so inspiring for everyone else to know that you're still working, as you said, going up that spiral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we all are. I think it was Richard Bach who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull said, if you're still alive, you're working on something.
That's good, yeah.
You know your work's not through if you're still here.
Mm-hmm. So I don't want to tap with you on seven figures, because there's a lot about seven figures that you're comfortable with. I think when you think seven figures, you're thinking in terms of sort of your whole company. And what I want to do is tap on an individual event and what it would be uncomfortable for you to charge.
Sure.
So if you think about an event, what feels like an unreasonable...
Well, I'll tell you what comes up for me on that is that I know a number of people who are involved in certain level mastermind groups. I think Tony Robbins charges $65,000 for his, and mm-hmm. I know there's others that are up to $100,000 platinum mastermind groups and so forth. And those numbers are bigger than I feel comfortable with. So we can go there if you'd like.
Super. And so just to be clear, what comes up for you when you think about charging, let's just pick a number. So let's say $75,000 for a mastermind group.
Mm-hmm.
And what goes through your head when you think about offering that?
Who would pay that for first?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly is that old fear comes back again about how will I be seen. You know, I've always wanted to be my essence is of service, and I want to be of service. And I guess there's some part of me that wants to be known as that kind of person, like a Gandhi or a Mandela or a, you know, that kind of a person. And
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure where that comes from or why, but that's in there.
Okay. And you feel that those things are inconsistent with you charging that much?
That's what I think gets in the way of it. I mean, at some level, if 20 people came to me and said, we each want to pay you $100,000 for a year of work, I'd go, sold. But they have to go out and market it and put it in the brochure. I remember, this is what also coming up for me, I remember when we were doing Chicken Soup for the Soul. See, I had no problem. When we sold Chicken Soup for the Soul, the company, to another company, I'm still involved with the production of the books, but when we sold the company, you know, I made tens of millions of dollars on that deal. I had no problem with that. And the reason is that we were affecting millions of people. We'd sold over 100 million books. So the mass market idea of selling a lot of books to people and charging $16, that felt like a fair price for a book. But when it comes down to my time and what that's worth and then how that's perceived as, oh, he's only in it for the money, I thought he cared about people. That's where it gets uncomfortable for me.
Oh, we're going to have so much fun, Jack.
Oh, I'm sure.
Okay. So you're in a position that you can tap, right?
I am.
Okay. So tap with me on the karate chop point.
Okay. What I'm going to do, I'm just going to move. I have a little headset microphone on. I'm just going to move that to the side just a little bit, so I might not be quite as loud as I'm responding. So tapping on the karate shop point, yes.
Okay. Even though there's no way I could charge six figures for a coaching program.
Even though there's no way I could charge six figures for a coaching program.
Who would pay that?
Who would pay that?
They would think I was greedy.
They would think I was greedy.
I would love to find a way out of this belief.
I would love to find a way out of this belief.
Even though there is no way I could charge six figures for a coaching program.
Even though there's no way I could charge six figures for a coaching program.
It feels so arrogant.
It feels so arrogant.
Who am I to charge that much for transformational work?
Who am I to charge that much for transformational work?
I'm open to an entirely new perspective.
I'm open to an entirely new perspective.
Even though I am totally uncomfortable with that idea.
Even though I am totally uncomfortable with that idea.
I'm so afraid of being perceived as greedy.
I'm so afraid of being perceived as greedy.
And losing my Gandhi-like image.
And losing my Gandhi-like image.
I love and accept myself just the way I am.
I love and accept myself just the way I am.
And I'm open to something new.
And I'm open to something new.
Tap for me on the eyebrows. I can't offer a six-figure coaching program.
I can't offer a six-figure coaching program.
Outside of the eye, no one would pay for that.
No one would pay for that.
Under the eye. Well, actually, I know people pay for that.
Well, actually, I do know people pay for that.
Under the nose. But would they pay me for it?
But would they pay me for it?
On the chin. I've never charged anything like that.
I've never charged anything like that.
Collarbone. It feels extraordinary to think about.
It feels extraordinary to think about.
Under the arms. There's no way I could charge that much money.
There's no way I could charge that much money.
Top of the head. People are used to something from me.
People are used to something from me.
Eyebrows. They're used to me being giving.
They're used to me being giving.
Outside of the eye. They're used to me offering transformation for a few thousand dollars.
They're used to me offering transformation for a few thousand dollars.
Under the eye. How could I possibly charge $100,000 for that?
How could I possibly charge $100,000 for that?
Under the nose. I'm not even sure I wouldn't feel greedy.
I'm not even sure I wouldn't feel greedy.
On the chin. I don't know that I can charge that.
I don't know that I can charge that.
Collarbone. And I'm really worried about what people will think of me.
And I'm really worried about what people will think of me.
Under the arm. If I put this out.
If I put this out.
Top of the head. And I get negative response.
And I get negative response.
Eyebrows. I'll know it was a bad idea.
I'll know it was a bad idea.
Outside of the eye. See, there Jack goes being greedy.
See, there Jack goes being greedy.
Under the eye. They get to the top and they just get greedy.
They get to the top and they just get greedy.
Under the nose. And I'm so afraid of that.
And I'm so afraid of that.
On the chin, because I want to see myself as a giver.
Because I want to see myself as a giver.
Collarbone. What if there was a way?
What if there was a way?
Under the arm. To see myself as a giver.
To see myself as a giver.
Top of the head. And still charge six figures.
And still charge six figures.
Eyebrows. Because one thing I know.
Because one thing I know.
Outside of the eye. Is that people have to step up in order to transform.
Is that people have to step up in order to transform.
Under the eye. And one of the ways people step up is by paying.
And one of the ways people step up is by paying.
Under the nose. When they put their money on the line.
When they put their money on the line.
On the chin. They are more committed and invested.
They are more committed and invested.
Collarbone. And six figures is a hell of an investment.
And six figures is a hell of an investment.
Under the arms. I know I'd get really committed people.
I know I'd get really committed people.
Top of the head. There's transformation just in that commitment.
There's transformation just in that commitment.
Eyebrows. That's something that I could certainly give.
That's something that I could certainly give.
Outside of the eye. Is the opportunity to step up.
Is the opportunity to step up.
Under the eye. The opportunity for people to say, I'm worth it.
The opportunity for people to say, I'm worth it.
Under the nose. And Jack's worth it.
And Jack's worth it.
On the chin. What if there are people out there right now?
What if there are people out there right now?
Collarbone. Who are working with someone else?
Who are working with someone else?
Under the arms. Because they value themselves more.
Because they value themselves more.
Top of the head. Than what I'm charging.
Than what I'm charging.
Eyebrows. That means I'm not in service to them.
That means I'm not in service to them.
Outside of the eye. I'll always be in service.
I'll always be in service.
Under the eye. I've got millions and millions of books out there.
I've got millions and millions of books out there.
Under the nose, I'm continuing to train people at very reasonable rates.
And I'm continuing to train people at various reasonable rates.
On the chin, I'll always be of service.
I'll always be of service.
Collarbone, but what if there are people out there?
However, what if there are people out there?
Under the arm, who are looking for a commitment and investment.
Who are looking for a commitment and investment.
Top of the head, and I'm not serving them.
And I'm not serving them.
Eyebrows, could I serve them?
Could I serve them?
Outside of the eye, the truth is I'm really good at what I do.
The truth is I'm really good at what I do.
Under the eye, I provide a lot of transformation for people.
I provide a lot of transformation for people.
Under the nose, what if I could offer it?
What if I could offer it?
On the chin, to those people who want that level of commitment and investment.
To those people who want that level of investment and commitment.
Okay. Tap the collarbone. Take a deep breath for me. So let's just say that your discomfort with this idea was a 10 before, whatever it was. What is it now compared to that?
It's pretty much gone. I mean, just the sheer logic of that was impactful, let alone the tapping. I feel very spacious inside, like a cathedral. And that's a funny image. Like, you know, remember old churches where the rich people would be up front and then the poor people would be standing in the back?
Yeah.
There's room in my church for everybody.
I love it. I love it. So I'm not hearing any resistance to the idea of creating a six-figure program for people who are looking for that?
No, I don't feel it at the moment at all.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Great work, Jack.
Very good. Just send your checks to Jack Canfield, P.O. Box 30880.
So I'm gathering that we might be able to look for a new offering from you?
I think so. I would look for that, yes.
Great. Wonderful. Is there anything else you want to get rid of while we're...
Oh, no. I'm very happy. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I want to underline this, actually, for the listeners on the call, because what we just did in about 10 or 15 minutes is could very likely be worth $1 million to you. I mean, if you start a six-figure coaching program and you get even 10 people in it, that's $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So the value of this last 15 minutes to you, assuming that you act on it and follow through, could conceivably be seven figures.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to underline that for the people who are saying, well, you know, what can I charge for a single session? Charge for the transformation, the value that you provide, not for the time that you spend.
Mm-hmm.
So. And I'll be happy to take your the commission check. All right. So I don't know if you can wrap yourself around any more limiting beliefs, because I can feel the openness and the spaciousness in you now. But I'd really love to hear from you a couple of mindset approaches that empowered you to make more money or empower you to make more money. It's like, what are some of your favorite things to believe about money or to step into that?
Well, I think, you know, what really shifted it for me was a quote or a mantra or an affirmation that I picked up when I was studying with W. Clement Stone. And I'm not sure if it's his or it could be a number of different people. I think, what's her name, Florence Scovel Shin, S-H-I-N-N, wrote a book about abundance and manifestation back in the 30s, I think, or 40s. That might have come from that. But anyway, the thing I started repeating when I was in my, I said probably about 29, in that range, 26, 29, was God is my infinite supply. Infinite, keyword. And large sums of money come to me quickly and easily under the grace of God for the highest good of all concerned. And that little phrase, which I used to say over and over every morning, and then I added when I decided my first goal was to make 100,000 in 1 year, which went from my 8 to 100, which was a 12 times multiplier, was that I added as I easily earn, spend, and invest $100,000 a year to the end of that. And within 1 year, you know, I'd gone from $8,000 income up to $92,000 or $93,000. So it literally shifted everything. And so I'm a big believer in you know, keeping those phrases in front of you, and saying them and having them become part of your belief. Now, obviously, I don't have to wake up every morning and affirm that I'm Jack Canfield. I know that. And so once you know something, I think you can drop it. I feel like after the session we just did, I feel like I know that I can charge that amount of money for something. And so perhaps then an affirmation isn't as required. But that was a big piece for me, was that I think another thing was the working with ideal scenes. In other words, like having the vision of where I want to go in front of me and working backwards from that. So always visualizing where I wanted to be. And then the thing I teach and that I live is this concept of act as if. You know that when we do our trainings, which you've attended, we always end with a come as you'll be party, where everyone comes for at least an hour or two and acts as if they're the person with all the achievements that they would have achieved and all the qualities that they would be expressing 5 years into the future. And so I've always acted as if the money's coming. I've had these limits we just worked on, those are pretty high limits for most people. And mm-hmm. I've lived a very abundant life. I live in a mansion in Southern California, and I've got all the nice toys that people want to have. But the reality is that before I could even afford a nice suit, I bought one. And I bought nice ties, and I looked the part. I would, whenever I could, I would upgrade to first class. I would always, if I was going to take a woman out for a drink, I'd do it at the Ritz-Carlton. Drink might have cost $3 more. Wouldn't eat dinner there, but, you know, we'd have a cocktail there. And I kept putting myself in the space of already being there and acting as if I was there and acting as if whatever I wanted was just around the corner and coming. Never worried about money. Never, I mean, my staff will tell you, Jack just doesn't worry about money. He just trusts that it's going to come. And I remember a quote from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was the guy who started the TM movement, Transcendental Meditation. And one of my friends, John Gray, who I just recently interviewed for our community, was studying with him back in the 60s and 70s and said that at one point they were going to buy this place in Fairfield, Iowa. And they said to Maharishi, well, Maharishi, that place is for sale for, like, you know, tens of millions of dollars. It was an old college that had gone under, and they wanted to put their main ashram there. And they said, where's the money going to come from? And he said, wherever it is now. Which I just love, you know. And so I've kind of always had that sufficiency, I guess. And I've had abundance. I just haven't had the sense of worthiness at the level that I perceive the abundance at. Now they feel more lined up inside of me. But that's always been a big piece for me. And I think another thing I decided early on was, like, how much is enough? And for me, I came up with a number that if I had $30 million in liquid assets, that at a 6% interest rate, that would be producing $1.8 million a year, that after taxes, that would leave me with about $1.2 million to live on, which is plenty. And so just establishing, well, where do I want to be? What does it mm-hmm. look like? And, you know, I'm probably worth about $22 or $3 million now, so I've got about $8 million to go. And just knowing that number, I think, it's been an important piece for me. And knowing it was coming, just in this next year, I can see several million extra dollars coming in from things that are in play. And now with this thing we just did, maybe another million. So that's been a big piece of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've given so many nuggets. I hope people go back and listen to this call multiple times because I think it's really powerful.
Let me say one other thing, too. It occurred to me, if you don't mind, that one of the things I just recently learned from Joe Vitale, I think I've lived it, but I didn't articulate it. And Joe Vitale is a man that's in a secret, and he's written a book called The Attractor Factor and so forth. And one of the things he talked about at a recent meeting of the Transformational Leadership Council was this importance of acting on your your inspirations. And I believe that when you're in the space that I feel I'm in right now after our tapping, and that when you're in when you meditate, and you're in when you are tapped into the source, because we can not just tap into six figures, but you can tap into your source. And then what happens is that you now have these downloads that occur of inspiration, intuition, insights, awarenesses, aha moments, etc. And that when that occurs, you need to act on them. And I think a lot of times we've been taught not to trust our intuition. But when you're in this space that tapping gets you into, and that sense of that open, empty cathedral place that I was feeling, and that going from a 10 to a 0, there's nothing there blocking the energy flow or the consciousness, that what happens is there are downloads that occur, whether they're from your high self or whether they're from God or the source of universe, infinite intelligence, however you want to hold that, they come through. And Joe gave a wonderful example of this abundance mentality when he said he had been practicing Ho'oponopono, which is another clearing method that comes out of the Hawaiian shamanistic traditions. And Joe's also a big proponent and supporter of tapping as well. But what happens is that he was driving home. He's a car nut. He just bought a Rolls Royce. He has about, I don't know, 5 or 10 cars, something like that. And they're all pretty cool cars. And so he just bought this Rolls Royce. I think it was used, but it was a big car. And he's driving it back from the dealer, and had this thought come in. He said, God, this car is big enough to run a mastermind group in. If you've ever been in a large Rolls Royce, they are. So he had this thought, gee, what if I could do that? And so he gets home, and he said, I just had this idea. I've learned that as soon as I have it, I should act on it. So he wrote an email, and he sent it out to his mailing list, which is tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people. And he said, I just had this great idea. I bought this Rolls Royce, and I'm going to do single or group masterminds, and it's $10,000 for a day. You basically email me and send me a credit card with a $2,000 deposit so I know you're serious, and I will pick you up at the airport. I think he lives in Austin, Texas, and I will pick you up at the airport. We'll drive around in my Rolls Royce. We'll have a mastermind session. We'll just talk. Ask me any question you want. I'll work with you. We'll stop at my country club. We'll have lunch. We'll drive around some more. We'll have a wonderful dinner, and I'll drive you back to the airport. And he said, that's $10,000. He just put it out. And he said within a week he had like 20 or 30 people wanting to do it. And he said, wow, I just had an idea. I acted on it. Here it is, $300,000 later, pretty much paid for the car. So it's that level of being willing to trust what comes through when you're in that open space and act on it. And he said that there's, and I believe this is true, I've experienced it, there's an energy when the inspiration comes, there's a vortex, there's an opening, like, you know, the parting of the Red Sea when Moses walked across, and there's energy to support the idea in that moment in time. And if you put it in your someday maybe file, and you come back to it 3 months later, that same energy field that supported that doesn't exist in the same way. It doesn't mean you can't do it, but that power and the alignment may not be there in the same way. So it's just that willingness to act on the inspirations. I think that's been a big piece of me in this idea of abundance consciousness. When the idea comes, act on it. Now, obviously, ideas come like $100,000, and you're going to hit up against these blocks, and that's where you tap with your coach or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tapping really does, I think, speed things up because, well, I had that same flash of inspiration last year when I said, I want to make $20,000 really fast. And you probably remember I started this little Tapping into the Success Principles class to do research for the book. And I said, if I get 400 people in the class at, you know, $50 a piece or something like that, it would, you know, basically I'd get my $20,000. And that is exactly, I mean, I implemented it in about 10 days. Mm-hmm. And pulled it off, and you were kind enough to come in and do a bonus call for it, and it just really felt like one of those divine downloads that had I not acted on it in the moment, that would never have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, not quite the same scale as Joe Vitale's yet, but so it felt like a huge thank you to Source for me.
Yeah, well, you have to act on the ideas you get, and and I think both of us now are having bigger ideas because we've been exposed to bigger ideas and we've had the courage to tap on them and to release the blocks and take that action. I mean, the call we're doing right now is an up level of what you did in the past. And so the same thing is true for me. And You know, I'm literally, we're going to take a trip to Egypt with about 40 students, March of 2012. And I've been working with a woman named Nikki Scali, who has been taking shamanistic trips to Egypt and taking people to temples and, you know, all these places and the Sphinx and so forth, and having these wonderful transformational experiences happen for people, big energetic openings. And I think up till now, the most she's ever charged is $7,000, and we're going to be charging something closer to $20,000. And I was having some concern about that until about 20 minutes ago. So it's all good. It's all good.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think I've heard from the people in this class that I'd love you to address is, how did you get over feeling guilty about toys? Because I know that you're a generous person. You give lots of your time. You give lots of your money. And mm-hmm. you also choose to live the lifestyle consistent with your earnings. So
yeah.
Did you have any overcoming to do there, or was that never an issue for you?
No, I did. I did. I think the all of a sudden, I went from making about $140,000 a year to $6 million in 1 year in about 3 years. So that was a huge, huge breakthrough. I had no problem buying a bigger house. I knew it was an investment. I knew I would have my staff working on the property with a big estate. So there were a lot of easy ways to rationalize that one, although it was a stretch. I mean, I had to work with my accountant to convince myself we could afford it. But we could, and we did. But where it got uncomfortable was like buying clothes, buying art, buying expensive furniture. You know, I leased my cars. It works better for the business, but I leased, you know, top-end Lexuses and so forth. So I'm not a Ferrari guy. I don't own a Rolls-Royce or a Bentley. And if I was making $100 million a year, I would. But I feel like I live my abundance commensurate with the level of wealth I do have. And I'm a big believer in not spending my principal and living off the interest of the money we've accrued over the years. So that's the way I play. And yet, you know, I've got a 6,500-square-foot house, and it's got a stable and barn and beautiful pool and you know, 3.5 acres of land. And my staff works here, and I've got great art in my home and all of that, and take great vacations. I travel first class. I don't have a private jet. I looked at that, and when I looked at the cost of it, it just didn't pan out. I mean, could have I afforded it? Yes. Did it make sense economically? No. And so, you know, there's some decisions where your ego gets overruled. But I remember when I bought my first cashmere sweater, it was like, whoa. And then I bought a second one, and then I bought one in every color. and at first I was a little uncomfortable with it. And then I went, you know, hey, this is supporting people. They're making money making these sweaters and the sheep growers and all of that. It's all part of a cycle. And what I learned is that, you know, I think you can overconsume. I'm totally convinced of that. That's why a lot of my money goes to charity, and we have a profit sharing plan in my company, and everyone does well when we do well, et cetera. I'm very generous that way. But I don't have a problem, you know, flying first class and buying really nice clothes. And, you know, I haven't bought a Brioni suit yet that's about $4,500, but my suits cost $2,500 and they're custom made. So I don't kind of go to the far extremes. I don't own a Ferrari, but, I'm very comfortable, but I did have to overcome it. I mean, it was about 2 years of feeling guilty and what would people think and all of that, and not at all. But it's funny, last night I was watching, my wife was watching something when I walked in, but to go to bed. It was a reunion of the Real Wives of Beverly Hills, I think is the name of it. And mm-hmm. it's all these people that are extremely wealthy and just normal, neurotic like the rest of us. But, you know, the jewels and the fear if I don't have the right handbag to match my shoes, and it's all about who has the biggest toys, and that stuff doesn't interest me. You know, that's just the consumer culture gone awry. I think that we need to keep money in circulation. That's what I know, is that if money doesn't move, then people don't eat. But maybe someday we'll create a different economic system. But right now it's the one we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that perspective. And it sounds like tapping might have speeded up the process for you, but it was still an incremental process where, you know, you get used
yeah.
to a little bit more abundance and a little bit more abundance. And
I think that what I would recommend, now that we know tapping exists, is that, and I do it often, I don't do it perhaps often enough, and it's good to have people like you in my life reminding me, is that anytime you find yourself drawn towards something, but have a hesitation, have fear, have guilt, that's when you want to tap. And I believe if you tap and you release the fear and the guilt, then whatever's right will emerge. You may still decide not to do something, but it won't be because of fear. It will be because you're in this place of true centeredness and true knowingness, having released the fears and the doubts and the limiting beliefs. And from that place, I believe you always make the right decision. And the decision often will be to do the thing that maybe you were afraid to do or felt guilty about or felt you'd be judged for. And sometimes you may make the decision, oh, that was just my ego and I don't need to go there. My real fear was they won't see me as successful if I don't have, you know, the Mercedes or the Armani suit or the Rolex watch or the Mont Blanc pen. And that's equally fear-driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love that you said that, because that's something that that I like to address with clients and the people I teach, is that you can't, people say, how do I judge between what my intuition is telling me and what fear is telling me? And what I tell them is, get rid of the fear, and all that will be left is the intuition. So once you tap on all your concerns about something, I think you'll be left with a very clear idea of what you need to do.
And I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, great. So sort of to wrap up and to leave us on even a higher note than we've been on so far, well, let's talk about actions to take to generate this kind of money.
Well, I think that to generate large sums of money, there are only a couple things you can do. You can either make or create things that cost a lot of money and sell them. Like if you have a $100,000 coaching program or training program or product that you develop, I know a guy, Dave Ellis, who's a coach, who's a friend of mine. He charges $100,000 for a year of coaching. He has 10 clients, makes $1 million. And then he does some other things as well. He's developed a book for college kids to help them empower themselves through their college experience, and he does trainings for teachers and sells the textbooks and makes a lot of money from the textbook as well. But the point being, if you have a product that sells for $20, you got to sell, I don't know, what is that, 50,000 of them or something to make $1 million. But if you have one for $200, then it's 5,000. If you have one for 2,000, it's 500, et cetera. So, you know, people that sell private jets only have to sell one or two a year to make a very good living. So you either generate something that costs a lot of money and you figure out how to do that, like we just did with me, or you have to go to something you can mass market, like a book or a CD or a television show or a website that people belong to a community and charge $20 a month for or whatever. Or you can have a newsletter, like one of my friends, Dan Burris. He works with Fortune 500 companies. His newsletter, I think, is like $25,000 a year. He's a future trend guy, and these companies will pay that to be ahead of the trend so they know what they have to do to keep in the marketplace and have their products be relevant to what's occurring with miniaturization, globalization, moving toward electronics like e-books as opposed to hard paper books and so forth. You don't want to be caught behind the curve. So it's either having something that costs a lot of money or having something you can mass generate. With mass generation, what we found with Chicken Soup was the power of the internet, the power of television and radio. You know, we were able to reach lots and lots of people. And then affiliate marketing, which didn't exist until recently with the internet. You can do something and mail it to your mailing list for me, and I can do the same thing for you. When The Secret came out, 12 million people got an email on the same day because there were 25 people in that movie who all sent out a teaser about The Secret, come watch the trailer, on the very same day, many people getting 5 and 6 emails, one from John Gray, one from me, one from John Azraf, going, oh my God, this must be a really big deal. And that sold, you know, 30 million copies of that DVD in a very short period of time, making it the largest grossing, you know, independent DVD film ever made. It's still the number one DVD in China right now. So the reality is that you've got to find something you can leverage. It doesn't require you, like a DVD or a book, or you can do large markets like teleseminars like you're doing right now. Largest teleseminar I ever heard of was a guy who had, forgetting his name right now, it's not important, but the point being he charged $100 per person, and he got, I think, 100,000 people on his seminar, 10,000 people at $100, and he made $1 million in one-hour seminar. So that's only possible because he was well-connected, he did the affiliate mailing thing, and the internet was available and bridge lines and so on and so forth. So it just, I'm just trying to stretch people's imagination to what's possible when you use leverage, and the internet has provided us with leverage like unknown before. I do my Ask Jack call every month, and we get people from 42 countries on that call. Well, that wasn't possible until the internet made phone calling cheaper and cell phones cheaper and all the stuff that we now take for granted. You couldn't do that before. Paul Horn is a friend of mine who is a flutist, whatever you want to say, was recording. He was a studio musician. He was also a student of the Maharishi, he told me one day. And he was over there and he said, I don't want to work. I want to work half as much, but I don't want to give up my money. And the Maharishi said, well, then double your price. He said, but if I double my price, no one will hire me. He said, it's not true. People will hire you, but only about half as many. And so, studio musician with $300 an hour, he raised to $600, got half as much work, but the $600 made him the same amount of money, so he got his thing. So you can charge more. You might have fewer clients, but you get more, and so you make more. And so there's just, there's only a few really, if you really think about it, there's not that many ways to do this, but leverage and raising your fees. Reaching more people through marketing. I would say everyone should study internet marketing. If you're a coach, you're an author, you're a speaker. And the other thing is expand your capacity to reach people, meaning that if you're a coach and you're working with individuals, start doing group coaching, do teleseminars, study speaking so you can stand up as I've done in front of audiences of 20,000 people and sold $165,000 worth of product in the back of the room. And I know people, one of my friends, David Wood, has had a $12 million day in the back of the room. Sold $12 million worth of products and future trainings in one-hour seminar. So just, it's possible if you have the product and you have the capacity to enroll people. So study marketing, study sales, study enrollment, and neuro-linguistic programming, all those kind of things that will allow you to enroll people into your game. And I think the other thing would be practice the rule of five, which is do five things every day to move your breakthrough goal forward, your breakthrough, not your everyday doing, but this new breakthrough you're trying to create. Have a coach or a mentor or a mastermind group or an accountability partner that will work with you so you're held accountable to doing these stretch activities. And keep training. They say that it takes 10,000 hours to master something, about 7 years of work. So have patience. But have persistence, have focus. And if you do that, like us, we've sold 125 million books. I've trained hundreds of thousands of people. I've given over 1,000 radio and TV interviews. I've been on Oprah, Montel, Larry King, etc. And all that came from doing one thing at a time with excellence toward the vision, every day focusing on what I wanted to create and holding myself accountable.
I love it. Thank you. That list alone that you just gave of things to do and actions to take is just worth the whole price of admission. So I really appreciate that.
I'm Pamela Bruner from MakeYourSuccessEasy.com. I hope you enjoyed the Million Dollar Audio. Please visit MakeYourSuccessEasy.com to get additional great resources to help you grow your business, enjoy your marketing and sales, and have it all be much, much easier.